everyone, and welcome to episode 102 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. There are a whole lot of super common myths about the Middle Ages that cling like barnacles to our collective consciousness, despite being pretty easily disproved. One of the most common is the idea that everyone was born in one place where they spent their entire lives wandering around inside a tiny little box of an area, and then they died in the same place. In reality, of course, there were lots of opportunities and reasons to travel, sometimes just because. I know that a lot of us can definitely sympathize with that urge right now. This week, I spoke with Dr. John F. Romano about traveling in the Middle Ages. John is an associate professor and the chair of the history department at Benedictine College. His academic work covers both travel and liturgy, and his most recent book is Medieval Travel and Travelers, a Reader. Here's our conversation on the reasons people traveled, their methods of transportation, and some of the ways in which taking a trip in the Middle Ages wasn't all that different from today. Well, thank you, John, for joining me to talk about medieval travel and travelers. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, it's nice meeting you as well.
So I think that we need to start with the real general misconception that people were born in one spot and they stayed in that spot their entire lives. So tell us about medieval travel. Who was traveling?
Sometimes the people we see the most are people at the absolute top of the social ladder. I mean, you think about people like diplomats, for instance, who needed to travel. I mean, think about people traveling for military expeditions, the Crusades, and people think about medieval travel. But in fact, I mean, the further you go into it, there are all sorts of people, for instance, traveling on pilgrimages, many of whom are not necessarily of the highest class. Well, there are merchants who, I guess, are closest to our modern day middle class who are traveling on a regular basis and going across the Mediterranean. In part, the misconception comes about because when you get to our source material, you don't necessarily have good representation by people lower down the social scale because they simply didn't have access to writing. But we assume when we see a pilgrim who can write, that's really just the tip of the iceberg. And there's all sorts of other pilgrims there who didn't have that ability.
So when we talk about pilgrims, is that the most common reason for an ordinary person, say a peasant or someone lower on the social ladder, is that the most common reason for them to be traveling is for a pilgrimage?
Yeah, for the most part. There are other reasons why one might travel, but in terms of an ordinary sort of institutionalized reason. In Christianity, of course, it's something that's praiseworthy, something one might do. When it comes to Islam, even more so, it's one of the fundamental five pillars. So if at all possible, if they have means, a Muslim is supposed to take that pilgrimage in his or her lifetime. Now, I assume it often didn't necessarily happen in one's lifetime, but it was always the ideal anyway.
Do you find that there is, or do you think that there is a lot of invisible traveling back and forth between families from village to village or between friends that are maybe not necessarily within the same parish?
Probably. It's probably the best way to say. I mean, it would certainly make sense. You assume it's one of those historical silences that there are all sorts of people sort of traveling on a local basis that we just wouldn't know about it unless there's some reason we have to know about it. And there often isn't.
Okay, so the next question has to be, how are they traveling? Is everybody traveling by foot? How are they getting around at this time?
By foot, you definitely do see people, depending on how much money one has, on horseback, donkeys, by ship, depending upon where you're traveling. For instance, in West Africa, going across the Sahara on camelback, perhaps a little more exotic, and certainly not in Western Europe proper, but.
Were a lot of people traveling within wagons, or were they mostly astride a horse when they were traveling?
Combination of the two. Even having a horse was not necessarily something that everyone could have in the first place. So there certainly were some people just traveling by foot, especially if it was a local region.
Have you seen anything that kind of indicates that there might be some sort of public transportation, like in that people would be able to make money from getting people from one place to another and have a regular route to do that? Or is that something that is kind of a more modern thing?
When you see people, for instance, hitching a ride, or normally it seems to be a sort of an improvised transaction where, if someone or a small party needs to be able to travel somewhere, they'll pay for passage, but it's not necessarily something I see it as being really as much of a business, at least from the sources that I've looked at.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like that before, so I was just curious as to whether you had either. One of the sources in your book talks about renting camels to cross desert regions, and you had to pay a little bit more. Do people have horse rental businesses? Someone asked me this question the other day, so I thought I would bring it to you. Like a horse rental business, kind of like a car rental business, where you hire the horse that you need, and maybe you have to pay more if you leave it at the other end instead of bringing it back. Was there anything like this in the Middle Ages?
I've never seen it. I'm not excluding that, you know, it may exist in some way, but to the best of my recollection, I've never seen any sources in any case. So it sounds like a reasonable idea anyway, but I just don't know of it.
So there are lots of cases in medieval romance. And there's a case in your book as well where a horse dies on the road because it's too difficult. Mm-hmm. So where would you get another horse? Would you just kind of ask the local farmer if you could buy the horse? Or would that be something that you could maybe get from a monastery? Like, how would you pick up a new horse if you accidentally rode it?
It just appears you really have to think very quickly on your feet. You do see some of these, I think of some of the Jewish travelers, for instance, some of these letters from the Cairo Genizza, where, you know, sometimes they would end up after a shipwreck with no money at all. And the question is, what do you do? Now, in some cases, you can call in old loans from people and scrape together a little money. In some cases, you get some money from charity. But I think by extension, a very similar thing seems to happen if all of a sudden your horse, your camel dies. You just have to see what's around you. And hope that some way, either by barter or by having enough coinage, you were able to purchase it. It could put you in desperate straits, depending upon where you were at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think one of the letters that you have in here is from one of the Jewish merchants that you mentioned. And he's writing to say, please get back to me as fast as you can, because I don't want to have to sell the clothes off my back to stay here any longer.
And you get some idea of, like, you know, the meaning of that phrase, you know, to sell, you know, the shirt off your back. You literally may have to do that.
Yeah, because shipwrecks were pretty common at the time, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Libraries were to fire in the Middle Ages. So were shipwrecks to do naval voyages. I mean, I really think it was quite a common experience. Yeah, we say at the bottom of the Mediterranean is sort of a vast graveyard of ships. Some of which, of course, are not medieval or ancient, too. I imagine that there must be, you know, thousands that are undiscovered there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you hear this in the sources all the time, a ship's getting wrecked and it happens so much, it's almost unbelievable. I mean, it happens to kings, it happens to peasants. There's shipwrecks just all the time.
Yeah. I think it's like White Ship or something where, yeah, I mean, if the royalty could go down, anyone could go down on these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Even when they thought they couldn't. I was talking about this on an earlier podcast with Charles Spencer and this being kind of a Titanic moment where the royalty didn't expect that they were going to crash the ship.
Yeah.
Even though statistically, you know, it was probably likely to happen at some time.
Well, one of the reasons I have that wonderful reading right at the beginning of the travelogue of Ibn Jubayr, it's not a shipwreck, he survives, but you have this absolutely fantastic storm. You feel as if you're living through it with them. And it's really quite a bit more interesting than the rest of his travel. I was the only excerpt I actually included from it. But it's so vivid that I couldn't, I certainly didn't want to avoid putting that one in.
Yeah. And I think those moments are important. It's not the only time that you see a shipwreck where the people will describe the storm was so bad that I made these promises to God. Now I have to live up to them.
Yeah.
So we were talking about people who get shipwrecked and that might leave them in kind of dire straits in terms of only having the stuff that they brought with them. Mm-hmm. So do you have an impression of the type of things that a person would bring with them? Like what would a pilgrim bring with him or her and how would they carry it with them?
Pilgrims tend to carry very little. I mean, they have their staff. They will sometimes have a pilgrim badge, the famous sort of shell of Santiago de Compostela. Maybe a little satchel with a few things in them, but very minimal sort of items with the anticipation that, in fact, you have to feed yourself along the way or find some way to get food. You bring too much, then you're weighing yourself down. There's a possibility, of course, too, that if you really do bring things that are expensive, especially as a pilgrim, the odds of them getting stolen are probably fairly high. So it would just be foolish. It's a different story when you talk about, for instance, you know, say a diplomat traveling with this enormous coterie of people, which, I mean, there's a certain amount of safety in numbers. I mean, the same thing, of course, would happen with, you know, you get these huge caravans sometimes, either going across the Sahara or in some cases going across the Silk Road, where you get part of the reason people sort of stay together in groups is simply for a personal protection, but also protecting their items. Most people tend to travel light, I think. Again, if you're a merchant, you don't have that luxury because that's your entire business.
Yeah, you have Marjorie Kemp in this book as well. From reading her book, it seems as if you kind of would come across a group of pilgrims, for example, hanging around a harbor, and they look like pilgrims, and you kind of attach yourself to them, and you all travel together. Yeah. Is that about right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think some of these things are very informal, the way that they come about. Marjorie Kemp's real problem was that many other pilgrims just tended to hate her because they saw her as being essentially sort of a drama queen, and to doubt her orthodoxy or whether she really had these visions at all. I should say, too, with students, and I imagine readers of the books, too, you get this sort of division when you read Marjorie Kemp because some people are fascinated by her and they see her. They love this form of piety, the sort of the crying and the visions. And other people say she deserves an Academy Award she cannot be for real. I wonder in this book in particular, because we think of her so much from that perspective of medieval piety, or especially this sort of elaborate sort of sentimental piety, but not necessarily also as a traveler. And it's also one of the few examples of a female traveler. It's one of the great frustrations that so many of the sources tend to be male. But she's at least one good example of that.
Yeah, I love that her traveling is one of my favorite parts of her story, because I think that the people she was traveling with are split down the middle as well, in exactly the same way, and they leave her behind.
Yes. And she claims they steal things from her, and even the priest doesn't like her all that much. So she has a hard time of it.
She does. But someone like Marjorie is going on a really long pilgrimage, like almost as long a pilgrimage as someone could do at the time. And they're crossing through a lot of borders at this time. So what was it like to cross over the borders of countries that are just, they don't have kind of checkpoints in the same way they do now. So what was it like to cross a border in the Middle Ages?
It varies considerably. I think about, for instance, this early medieval monk Bernard, whose account of Jerusalem, in essence, they get imprisoned at one point and entering into some of these Muslim territories. And essentially, they have to hand over a bribe to be able to continue on, even though their paperwork theoretically was in order. You'll see other instances in which traveling on the Mongols, for instance, where if you were working for them, someone like a Marco Polo, they would give you this pass that you could just show to people and flash, and then you immediately can go by with no problem and get supplies. Everyone else pays cash, essentially. You travel to the Mongols and you just basically have to choke up gifts, every single person you meet if you want to continue on. So other cases, you get the sense that people just sort of, drift by without being perceived. But I do think for at least some of these places, travelers were one people who were very easy to exploit, especially if you're talking about a small scale merchant or something like that, where, this person doesn't really know how high the taxes are. And so certainly if you get someone who's unscrupulous, they can just milk them from as much money as possible. And the only thing you can do about it is complain, but that doesn't get you very far.
So was it kind of the closest towns on the route that would be kind of where you would recognize that you were in a different country, just when you came across a border and you found a town, that would be kind of your first indication that you are in another land, is it?
Yeah, and certainly where they call the most attention to it. When you have medieval travelers, they get to cities, they're very happy in a way that, you see a lot more concentrated stuff. You go to a place like Alexandria, you can see the lighthouse. You're there. There's sort of a very clear landmark, whereas even the concept of, very strict borders, of course, wasn't something that really would have been very operative in the Middle Ages, like having a very strict border guard or anything like that. But you're right, the city certainly really dotted the landscape. And I guess you're right, it's easier to realize when you're in someplace new. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I want to come back to Bernard for a second, because that was something that jumped out at me when I read the book, was that you were talking about his paperwork being in order. And one of the letters that they got from the emir, I think, of the town, was describing the traveler. So it was very much like a passport. Now you'll see these monks. Here's what they look like. Please let them pass.
And
Bernard was writing his book, and I think you, in the introduction to that excerpt that you have in here, in part as a way of showing people the way to get to Jerusalem. So can you talk a little bit about how people would write for the people back home as kind of travel literature? Like, can you tell us a little bit about how people would describe what they're seeing for an audience back home?
Yeah, no, and this is something I don't even want me to talk about. It's not a source that I have in this book, but we have this very interesting 4th century account of this female pilgrim, Egeria, that is one of the first examples we have of this kind of thing, where she goes to Jerusalem and she writes this very lengthy letter back to, we assume to be, fellow nuns in Spain. She goes blow by blow through all the things that she's seen. But someone like Bernard, to point to this example, it's so list-like in the way that he reports things. It could serve as something like a guide. It's quite interesting for us in a way, because I think that when some students come to travel literature, they think that you're going to get something close to what we think of travel literature today, where the journey has to change you in some way and as a person. And so it would be unthinkable to write a modern day piece of travel literature without some idea of this internal monologue, or some idea of like how I as a person am different at the end of this experience. Where you do get some of these medieval accounts where it's just like, well, here's the stuff. You know, this is what I observed along the way. And you're left just with the question, well, okay, how did it change you as a person? Did it? One of the examples I have in the book, too, is Petrarch ascends this one mountain in Provence. It does what so many of these pieces of travel literature in the Middle Ages don't do. He actually reflects about that. This changed me as a person. And there was sort of this spiritual journey at the same time as there was a physical journey. But for many people like Bernard, these are the things that were in front of me. And that makes it more useful to a later pilgrim, because maybe I don't care about your religious experience as much as what I have to see next. For us, I think it seems strangely lacking to a modern reader in a way.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but you rarely do see that kind of transformational literature in this. It is very informational. It's more like Lonely Planet for monks.
Yeah. No, and I have another one, the Einsiedeln itinerary, this itinerary of churches and other important sites to see in Rome, where it doesn't even pretend, of course, to be in any sense travel literature or reporting on it, but in a certain sense, it's more honest in that it just says, oh, here we go. You're going to see this on the left, this on the right, this on the left, this on the right. And you know exactly what it's for. This is a checklist almost. Okay, I saw this church. Now it's time to see this one.
Yeah, and I think you really notice that, because they mention things like, here's a landmark. Like, you'll see the lighthouse and then you'll know you're in the right spot.
Yeah.
And I think in Bernard's, it's interesting. I think it was in his account where he talks about there being the churches in Jerusalem, and this is the center of the world. They say this is the center of the world.
And you'll get some of these medieval maps, of course, where, I mean, quite literally, Jerusalem is in the center of the world. Clearly, some people like Bernard totally believe that. It had scriptural basis, but yeah, but he found it, you know.
But you don't actually see a lot of maps included with this kind of itinerary, do you? Or is that something that I just haven't seen? It's not usual that you see the maps with those instructions at the same time, do you?
No, I mean, in fact, I mean, and some of the maps that we get, of course, from this period are, in our sense, not really maps at all. I mean, they're symbolic. They're meant to point out important religious sites or religious people and put them to some sort of, you know, a framework like that. Whereas many of the maps we have from the Middle Ages, they couldn't actually get you from point A to point B, but no one anticipated them that you would ever use them in that way. I include a few of those in the reader because I do think that sometimes they just blow students' minds, just sort of, you know, say, what is this? So, you know, why is there a one-footed person in this continent? You know, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, that's exactly right. If you look at a medieval map, you'll be like, okay, you will find this place if you hang a left at Jesus's feet, or
Yeah, all right.
that kind of thing. But I do want to come back to the idea of these pictures of fantastic people, like a person with a big foot, being part of medieval travel literature. So what did this kind of idea of working in the fabulous or the most wonderful, I'm thinking of like the wonders of the East. What was that for when people were writing medieval travel literature? Why did they include that stuff?
In some sense, these sort of like, these foreign people, very often these sort of monstrous people are always just a little bit further off than we are. One of the examples I have in the book is that someone like Pero Tafur will actually ask a question of another traveler, like, have you ever seen these people? So they're actively trying to find them without, of course, ever really encountering the one-footed person or the man who has like the head in his chest or all these various kind of peoples. I would take it as this sort of this great love of this the exotic, and similar to things like, rumors of these things that beastly people in the East supposedly do. They're cannibals and they do these, horrific sexual actions or this sort of thing. I mean, it's out there. It's always a little bit further off than we actually are, but it's one of those sort of strange things, exotic things that are there, kind of looming in the distance.
So, do you think it's kind of as a way to just entertain people or to make them curious about traveling, to make them want to travel, or maybe make them not want to travel?
It definitely makes them curious. And the fact that, I mean, I mentioned Pero Tafur, another one I don't have in this book, but William of Rubruck is another one where he actually, at one point, he's this Franciscan who traveled into the Mongol territories. And at one point, he has this paragraph reflection of, I haven't seen any of these people who I'm supposed, these exotic, monstrous people I'm supposed to see, which makes me think, first of all, they're very curious. They want to see these people, and it's almost a source of disappointment. I mean, one of the arguments that, I mean, I think you're pointing to is that, especially some of these sort of stories about the great bounty that is in the East, if you keep traveling, some historians have made the argument that it indeed, especially the ones that reward you more, this is one of the reasons why people want to travel. It's very difficult to prove that. It might have been on some people's minds, that who knows what's out there.
Yeah, I just kind of figure there's probably elements of all of these things in writing this kind of get people curious and wanting to travel. But it's interesting that you mentioned that this Franciscan saying, like, where are the dog-headed people? Because I was supposed to be seeing them. I bring it up because people actually were traveling far, far into the East. They were traveling South Africa. They were traveling, on the Indian continent. And they would know that these things were not really there, but as you say, it's always just a little bit further. If it's just over that mountain range that you don't feel like traveling over.
The most famous example, of course, is in terms of an individual they're seeking for is Prester John. But there's this sort of very interesting figure who's he's a ruler, but he's a priest at the same time, and he kind of lives in both realms. And where his location is never entirely clear. There's sometimes it seems like he's lived in sub-Saharan Africa. There's some sources that seem to imply he lives in India. There are others that seem to imply he's somewhere in the east, somewhere far, far in the east that we can't possibly get to. Again, it's never where you are. Is perhaps the only consistency here, and his realms are vast, but no one ever seems to actually see them and come back.
And the further away it is, the more exotic and wealthy it is, of
Right,
course.
all right. It can become even more wonderful in the mind.
Yeah.
And I mean, we assume. I mean, this sort of love of talking about these exotic things was certainly one of the reasons why I think Marco Polo becomes his book becomes so popular. It's a very frustrating book, I think, for those who are historians to deal with, because so little of it appears. I mean, nearly everyone thinks now he definitely traveled to China. There's always been this strain of thought, this minority strain that, oh, well, maybe he really didn't. But I think the vast majority of people now are pretty convinced that he did. With that being said, there's a big leap between saying he did travel to China and saying that what was recorded were definitely the things that he saw. I mean, so many of them appear to be just so exaggerated or so basically gussied up for the purposes of making them better to sell, that you wonder sometimes how much are even really his recollections, which is frustrating for someone who actually knows was there. he may not be playing fair with the person he collaborated with to create this book, or not necessarily telling you what happened, which is all we want to know.
That'd be too easy.
Yeah, so there would be no job for scholars if they just people just told us exactly what they saw. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and one of the ways they get around it always is to say, "Well, I've heard this. Yeah. People tell me this." That way, you never have to have seen it yourself.
Right. Yeah. You see this distancing a lot, I think, with some of these things, and especially when they want to include some of the more lurid things. Cannibalism is one of the good examples where it's just sort of like, you know, it's always them. Someone is far off and I heard it from someone else. And
yeah. The one that always kind of gets to me is where it's in the Wonders of the East where they talk about the pepper, right? And it's guarded by snakes, I think. And that one always seems kind of an odd one to come out with because people know how you get pepper. Like that's an easy thing to disprove. But the snake story is a better story.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things in your book is a phrase book that is between French and German. It's for people who are French, right, who are traveling to Germany. And it's got all sorts of good phrases in it, like, where are you from? Saddle my horse. It's got stuff like, do you have grain for my horse? And then insults too, like a dog's ass up your nose, which is a great one. So how often have you seen these phrase books come up? Is this a fairly common thing that people would make for each other, is phrase books?
No, it's very rare, and it's a very weird thing. The phrase book, it's not even complete. And in some cases, they couldn't figure out, or couldn't get someone to help them with the translation. And it's also, I mean, random at times. some of them, as you said, are completely make sense. You know, you want to be able to say, you know, where you're from and everything. And other ones, it seems to imply that you're basically just trying to figure out ways to have sex, protect your master, you know, doing things that are slightly... he shouldn't be doing, but it is a very weird thing, and we don't see a lot of them. One of the reasons I included it is it's so unique. It's possible, of course, that sometimes people just would scroll things down on, like, you know, a little piece of parchment or something, and, you know, have it with them. But that would be the exactly sort of thing that would be lost, and so we don't have it anymore. Whereas, for whatever reason, this one actually got copied in, and some of these phrases too just seem like, you know. It's hard to believe that this is would be one of your, you know, your top 50 sayings that you would have to have.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, using Duolingo or something and having it say like "voulez-vous coucher avec moi?"
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, yeah.
it's an amazing source because of the fact that it's so random. So I'm thinking that, and maybe you can set me straight on this. I'm thinking that maybe we don't have a lot of these phrase books because they would require literacy. Do you think that's why?
Yeah, that's a very good point. You're right. It would be useless for the vast majority of people. It is very interesting to think about. I mean, just, you know, how do you travel in a world in which by accidents of the way you grew up, that you're able to speak more than one language? You don't really have, like, you know, translator schools or things. So there's sort of like, you know, standard language schools. You can see in some cases in which, you know, people are really entirely dependent upon their translators. And if you don't end up having a good translator, you know, you're basically out of luck. This sort of merchant's handbook by this Italian merchant, Pegalotti, who spends a lot of time talking about, listen, if you're going to go and do this trading, you have to get yourself a good guide / translator. You know, I know what you're thinking. You should go, you just get the cheapest one possible so you don't have to pay. But trust me, it's going to be, this person's going to be worth their weight in gold. It's better just to pay more at the outset. Or else you won't be able to do it, transact any business.
I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's making me wonder if in certain places, like maybe Venice or something where you have a lot of trade, if there was any regulation for translators, or like, do they have a guild or something like that? Or is it kind of the luck of the draw? You find where they hang out and just try and hire someone.
It seems to me like it really is often totally the luck of the draw. One of the weird things, too, is that often translators will drop out of the sources. We know, for instance, this clergyman from who served as an ambassador of the Mongols, known as Ruben Sauma. We know he had Italian translators from one of these letters we have that mentioned him, that he had these two Italians who happened to know Persian because they were merchants. And so they could converse with him. The way that it's presented in the source, you know, this clergyman Saum is just speaking directly to all these people in Italy. the translators were always there. In some cases where, you know, they're translating this technical theological vocabulary, you just have to sit back and wonder yourself, what were they hearing exactly? You know, how is this coming out? These merchants just trying their best to be like, I don't know. I really don't know how to talk about the Trinity, but you know, I'm going to give it a go. I mean,
yeah, trying to find the exact word that you need for something that is completely foreign. That's right. A trick. That's a trick, yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, I was thinking that it might be easier for people who are like monks and nuns, like we're talking about, who learn Latin because they could speak Latin and pretty much anywhere they want that was Christian. Although I have no doubt that there's a lot of people in the Middle East that were speaking Latin just so that they could trade, yeah, and communicate. But one, but of the
even Latin, of course, can be difficult depending upon the time, yeah, and place. Because you think about, I mean, someplace like Italy where really Latin existed longer probably as a spoken language than other places. And, you know, someone in England, like you say, like, you know, a Boniface was just learning this out of a book. And then all of a sudden you have to go down and actually speak it to people who are speaking it as a living language. I can only imagine a time they had no idea what someone like that was, you know, sort of, you know, it's like the speaking this sort of perfect classical Latin, you know, they have no idea, I would think.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that like you might have been taught in an English monastery, for example, and the accent that you have in your Latin, yeah, is going to be completely different. Yeah. So you're still going to have to figure that out. But what I was going to say is that like there seems to be a huge willingness in people that are traveling to pick up other languages. And I think that kind of goes against the idea that not only do people stay in one place all the time, but maybe that they weren't interested in knowledge, where you see people who are traveling and they're like, I learned this entire language because I wanted to find out more.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, again, for different reasons too. I mean, you also probably get these merchants who probably learn, practically speaking, enough of the language to be able to transact business without necessarily having to master the language entirely. I imagine there must have been lots of people like that, or just, you know, pick up a few terms when they're abroad.
Well, this might be a tough question, but it's a related question. Have you seen any sources that would speak to the fact that gestures are cultural? So we have people that are crossing lines of cultural values or language. And do you have you seen any sources that suggest that these are the gestures that you might need to learn when you're trying to trade with people across different cultures?
This is not really trade, but at least one example that really leaps out to me is in Mongol territories, their initial attitude was that you would always trot out a picture or an image of some kind of the Khan. And no matter what foreigner you came into contact with, they would have to prostrate themselves on the ground in front of the Khan, which for them was entirely a political gesture of submission. There were some Christians who absolutely refused to say this is idolatry. And in fact, they even ended up killing a few of them. The attitude was being that, you know, you don't want to politically submit. Just to show you again, just how, in some sense, how changeable the Mongols were, or you're tolerant in some ways. Later on, they would only require Christians to sort of like nod. That would be enough. You know, that in fact, they had done the ritual submission well enough. Again, in the beginning, their attitude was complete intolerance because they felt that these people were protesting in some way, or, you know, they weren't willing to submit to the Khan's political authority.
See, that's helpful information to know, is the kind of stuff that you have to be told or you're not going to understand, yeah, it. And anyone that's traveled to a country that has a different culture than yours, has different language than yours, they're aware of the fact that they are not fluent in the gestures of the locals. Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that you need to learn. So where did you find this information about the Mongols in the picture? Was that recounted in travel literature, like someone saying, when you go to Mongol territory, make sure you do this? Where did you find it?
William of Rubruck does talk about this, and all he does is just bow his head. There are previous sources. It doesn't leap to my mind immediately where they talked about this sort of bloody response to people who weren't doing what they wanted. All sorts of customs too. I mean, with the Mongols, like you're not supposed to, for instance, as with many peoples, you're not supposed to step on the threshold when you enter into one of their tents. In fact, you could be liable for death. In some cases, with foreign travelers, they just chose to let them off. Another thing is when you go, for instance, to see certain political rulers, like the Byzantine Emperor, There was a whole series of gestures that you had to do to show your submission before him. Again, it seemed that there were people, masters of ceremonies, basically, who coach you through them if you didn't know what you were supposed to do, as you wouldn't doing this for the first time. But for Byzantines, it would have probably been, you know, in the court, it would have been second nature.
Yeah, that was going to be my question is, do you have people that are telling you this? And I would think that the amount of time that it takes you to get from A to B in the Middle Ages gives you a bit more time to be coached on this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right. And that makes me wonder as well, how common was it to have ambassadors from different places within a court or within the emir's court or things like that? How often would you see ambassadors from other cultures?
We assume that the kind of sources we have from ambassadors are really just a small number, or that really, in fact, there were hundreds upon hundreds of embassies. For the Mongols alone, I mean, I think that we always think of them, of course, as being these bloody conquerors, but they have this constant stream of people who are coming. And the Mongols, of course, their attitude is that, you know, you might as well submit now because you know, it's good that we're talking to you so we don't have to take all the trouble of conquering you later on. It also depends upon the place. I mean, some places just had regular interactions. One of the sources I have in the book, this Muslim ambassador from the Abbasid Caliphate, Ibn Fadlan, who travels up to what today is modern-day Bulgaria. That probably was a much more of a one-off kind of expedition where, you know, you get the sense in some of these territories moving through, they don't even know really how to deal with the ambassadors. You really shouldn't travel any further. This is a terrible idea, you know. And for them, it was clearly a much more unusual sort of expedition. In certain major courts like the Byzantine world, I mean, they just had standard guides. Here's how you deal with diplomats. This is what you show them on the first day. You know, this is where you put them. And so it was entirely a regular process. They knew how to deal with these people.
I was imagining it was more of a capital city thing. And that is kind of what you've outlined for us. But you mentioned embassies. Did embassies have, like, I'm not imagining that they would have the sort of kind of a sanctuary idea that they do now, but were embassies kind of a place where you would learn about another culture just by visiting the embassy?
They didn't usually have like a building that was just an embassy.
Yeah,
I mean, they have like you know, people who just travel, and then depending on the place, that they find somewhere to, like, you know what, to put them up. Certainly, when you have, like, you know, individuals traveling to other places as diplomats. I mean, I think some people take advantage of it to just, you know, sort of open their eyes up wide. And this one, Ghiyath al-Din Nakash, he was on the embassy of the Timurid Empire, essentially traveled to Ming China. It's this fantastic source because he just sort of opens his eyes up, and he's actually a painter. So he has these sort of very detailed impressions of everything he sees around him. And I do think for someone like that, there's a bit of wanderlust and a bit of desire just to sort of somehow communicate everything that he's seen back to people back at home.
I think for people like that, it would be kind of maybe a goal to work towards being in a position to travel, like becoming a merchant or becoming a translator or something like that, putting yourself in the position where you could travel. For regular people, I suppose you could just find a good reason to go on pilgrimage. Religion is always a good reason to travel in the Middle Ages. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, we think of the pilgrimages that stand out most in our mind are the sort of the big gun ones, like, you know, Rome or Jerusalem. But many people were taking much smaller pilgrimages, you know, that in the local region you tend to think where you don't even have to really go that far.
You just need to take a break.
Yeah, no, I mean, one can understand it.
Especially now.
Yeah. <I don't> know. Yes, many people have said to me that this is it's kind of a crazy idea to have a book on travel come out really just as the pandemic was. No one can actually travel. You know, sort of a form of escapism or whatnot.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly what the travel books were like in the Middle Ages too, right? To give you an imaginary escape. But thank you so much, John, for coming on to talk to us about it. It's such a pleasure.
Speaking with you.
Thanks. You can find out more about John's work on his academia.edu page at benedictine.academia.edu/John Romano. His book is Medieval Travel and Travelers, a Reader, and you can find it, along with all of the other books featured on the podcast, at our new shopfront at amazon.com/shop/medievalists, where everything you buy gives just a little bit back to funding the podcast. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, one of our columnists, Steve Mulberger, has just published a translation of The Chronicle of the Good Duke. It's a 15th century biography of Louis II of Bourbon. And it's one of those works that goes into really nitty-gritty of the Hundred Years' War. The Duke is like a French commander and gets into a lot of kind of fighting, lots of chivalry, things like that. It's a really fascinating thing. So we have the first of a couple of pieces from Steve looking at this text, and it's kind of starting in like why he actually translated it. So we have that. Also, we have Lucy Lemonnier on working women in southern France, and Murray Dom is taking a look at the TV series The Last Kingdom. So all that and more.
Oh, man, I'm really looking forward to that stuff. That's really cool. Steve Mulberger always has great stuff. And then articles on women, that's my jam. So thanks, Peter. It looks like a great week.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for keeping the Medieval Podcast on the air. Patrons can get access to all sorts of goodies like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from travel to tournaments, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, across social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist, and you can check out my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a spectacular day.